No, it isn't. That's kind of like what why we cry, but not really why turtles cry.
A VDH for the comet?
Yes, John.
It may have something to do with the confines of their shell, possibly trying to maybe stretch their lungs to get as much air as they can because of the confines of their shell. Go ahead.
That's an interesting one, but no, that's not it. I'll give you a clue. In general, what do you think most animal tears are made out of?
Saline.
Okay, so do you think that that could be kind of used as a reason why a turtle would cry?
Surrounded by saline.
It is, and that's the problem.
Are we talking about a water turtle or a land turtle here, Roy?
The way I phrase it was some turtles, but in this particular case, it's a sea turtle.
They're getting rid of excess saline.
Oh, got it. They're getting rid of excess saline. Are they getting rid of other things as well? Turtles, the thing with turtles is we sort of project ourselves, and I think, into most living things. At least I would if I didn't know better. And so we have kidneys, and we sort of assume that, you know, fish and other things have kidneys, but actually fish don't. Fish don't really have any, for say, lungs. They don't have a air interface. They have a liquid interface in their gills in the first place to exchange the dissolved oxygen. So as long as they have the gills to transfer the oxygen, they use the same mechanism to transfer excess salt and urea and other liquid contaminants. So for all intents and purposes, fish's gills work like our kidneys do. Reptiles, who are more closely related to the fish than to human beings, don't have kidneys either. They have something called the cloaca, which is a single opening at the end for everything. And very little salt and very little urea comes out that way. So they need another mechanism to get rid of all of the seawater salt that they ingest accidentally. So the method that some sea turtles use is through their tears. They concentrate the sodium, the salt, in their bloodstream into tears, and then they cry them away. Other turtles have a mechanism inside their mouth where they'll rinse their mouth with salt water. They're not drinking the salt water. They're using the salt water as a kind of a rinse to remove the material that's being produced that has the urea and the sodium. So turtles have no kidneys, but they have their own method of dealing with it. And so that's why some turtles cry to get rid of the sodium.
Hey, since I get so little of these right, you got to mail me that gold star, right?
It's in the mail. This would be a nice starting off point for a very, very, very short discourse on our kidneys. We all hopefully have one or two. Best to have two, but you can use one in a pinch. And I hope not too many people out there don't have any, because that can really make your life miserable. Most people think in terms of kidneys as common sense type of things. They realize that it gets rid of the water-soluble waste in our body, the urea and what have you, and they realize that the fluid that they take in has to go someplace, although some of it is lost through breathing. Some of the moisture is evaporated through exhalation. Some is a loss in perspiration, but you never make up, you never lose that much fluid that way. So you need a method to maintain your fluid volume maintenance. But I don't know if everyone realizes that it's incredibly important for your electrolyte balance. You know, you hear about these sports drinks, you know, get back your sodium, get back your electrolytes. But it's very important that your electrolytes in your body be maintained at a very specific concentration, or else your body goes completely out of whack. And so there are mechanisms in your body to counter excessive salt, excessive potassium, and excrete it into your renal tubules and into your bladder and into your urine. And also, in addition, pH balance is incredibly important. Normal non-alkaline, unbasic liquid is a pH of 7. Human beings don't do well with a medium like that. We require it to be a little alkaline. We do best when our pH is somewhere between 7.35 and 7.45. It's a little alkaline. Not as alkaline as seawater. Seawater is around 7.5 to 8.4. So it's our kidneys are one of the important methods that we use to maintain our pH balance. There are other short-term things. There is our respiratory centers. If we're developing too much acid in our bloodstream, lungs will breathe more heavily and blow out more carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide with water in your body turns into carbonic acid, which is a weak acid. So that way they can shift the pH balance by changing your respiratory rate. And then there are internal buffers in your body, bicarb and carbonic, that can kind of even out things for the short haul, but not for the long haul. If you didn't have your kidneys, eventually you would develop higher and higher acidity, and a lot of your proteins wouldn't work the way they're supposed to. That's one of the many reasons why kidney failure and uremia can cause death. So it's very serious, but it's not only just soluble waste elimination and fluid maintenance. It's electrolytes and it's a pH balance. So I thought it might interest you guys to have a little short discussion of how kidneys work.
Roy, Mother Nature designed human beings, so to speak, with two kidneys. Mother Nature must have decided that for survival reasons, among others, two is really required, because she paid a pretty heavy price to have a second one where you have to nourish it, feed it, produce room for it, and whatever. So there's got to be a good reason why we have two. A very altruistic person will sometimes donate one of their kidneys because they seem to think simplistically, well, I got two, I can spare one, because they've got a friend who's on dialysis and they want to help them out. My guess is, and here's my question, I'm guessing there's a significant risk the human being who donates a kidney is taking when they give away one of the kidneys and now live the rest of their life on only one. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, it puts them at a somewhat greater risk, because if you have two and something goes terribly wrong with one of them, you can pretty much survive. There's a lot of people with a single kidney. There are some people born that way. And they can live a perfectly fine life. It just puts you at a slightly increased risk that if that one kidney has a problem, you have an enormous problem. But people can survive with one. There's a lot of redundancy, thankfully, in the human body. The human liver has two lobes. We could do probably just as well with the larger of the two lobes by itself, but we have two. So there's a lot of symmetry that goes into biology that doesn't have obvious benefits that I can think of, but still occur.
Thank you.
Problem. It's an incredible thing when someone donates a kidney to someone else. I mean, sometimes it's in the family, sometimes it's a friend, sometimes it's a stranger, and I find it remarkable, and it demonstrates the general generosity of human beings, which is a nice thing to see. Unfortunately, with the news, we tend to read about people shooting other people up. But every day people donate organs, and they put that little mark on their driver's license to be an organ donor, and that's a great thing.
I'm guessing you, as a physician, have to be extremely careful about tissue matching so you don't run into a rejection syndrome after that donation, which could, in theory, make the donation a pure waste. Over to you, Roy.
There's a lot of typing, especially with kidneys. They do a genetic assay of antigens, and they test whether there's compatibility. Unfortunately, unless you're getting a kidney from an identical twin, there's inevitably some degree of foreign antigen, and people have to take medications which kind of shut down portions of their immune system, which lead to risks of other problems. So, but, you know, it's better than nothing. Eventually, once again, I think genetics is going to solve a lot of these problems. I can perceive of the day when they'll be able to engineer a cloned kidney that's the perfect phenotype for the individual. You know, it might take a little bit of time to grow one, but that's sometime in the future, soon, hopefully.
For people who do experience failure, kidney failure, from what I've read, high blood pressure is one of the major causative agents of kidney failure. Is that true, Reverend?
I mean, unfortunately, there's many roads to Rome, as the old thing goes. There's many ways to screw up your kidneys. Over the long haul, diabetes, hypertension, some infectious processes produce it. Some drugs and chemicals can accelerate it. There's unfortunately loads of different ways that you could do it. And sometimes you have an autoimmune disorder where your body just gets deeply confused and just attacks it for all it's worth. And it's sort of a shame. I remember before I went to medical school, I remember reading in the Colorado section of the Daily News, Downstate Medical School had a medical student who was a dialysis patient. And that made the news, and I remembered it. And when I went there, she was kind of a semi-famous student. But unfortunately, and it's been known to happen, she was on dialysis. For whatever reason, they couldn't get a transplant for her. And after a while, sometimes you simply can't tolerate dialysis. And she got sicker and sicker, and she passed away before she graduated medical school. So, I mean, dialysis has been a godsend to so many people, but ultimately everyone's kind of looking for a transplant solution.
Tune in, 1YDY.
Thanks.
So getting to how the kidneys work, and as I recall, you have the Bowman capsule where the renal pressure forces your glomerular filtrate rate out, and the liquid is recaptured in the loop of Henle, or loops of Henle, because there's lots and lots of them. My question is, why when you do something that's consume something that's a diuretic, like caffeine or perhaps alcohol, do you not have a corresponding increase in the efficiency of the loop of Henle to recapture some of that liquid?
Depends on the diuretic. I mean, there are a lot of diuretics that work directly at that tubule that change the absorption rate. And so if you change the absorption rate, you effectively dilute the material that's going out into your ureter and your bladder. So it's at the level of the permeability for the most part.
Doesn't renal pressure have something to do with it?
Doesn't have a direct effect on the diuretic hormones and the other chemicals. That's kind of a lockdown process. There's very little regulation past the arterial pressures.
Thank you. You know, it's just been many years since high school biology, and I'm trying my best to remember.
Remember it a lot. I mean, I don't know if they got into that detail back in high school in biology. My memory of things, I remember much more about chemistry than biology because I only took 1 year of biology. I took 2 years of chemistry. And my last year, very weird in that the guy teaching it was teaching it out of notes. He didn't quite know what it was that he was teaching because whenever we tried to ask him, he kind of confused the issue. And it was only when I got into college that I figured out that he was teaching organic chemistry.
I did have OCHEM in college, and I thought that was a lot more work than either PCHEM or high school chem, but no, I think for biology from high school. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm conflating various memories, but that's where I think I got it.
So maybe you had a better biology class than I did, or a better memory. Let's see. I'm trying to think of something. I shot right out of my head. Oh, well.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm done. And one whitey white.
Okay, very good. Before I hand it over to Paul, just one other little question. What do you think is the difference between, say, the salt content in seawater and the salt content in your body? Do you think it's twice? Do you think it's three times? Do you think it's four times?
Can you just give us a hint when you told us that our pH was slightly alkaline?
No, pH isn't related to a salt concentration.
I was thinking perhaps when you said the pH gave us the ability to deal with salinity, and you were describing how the Red Sea, how the ocean was saltier than we are. But perhaps you were sending us down that direction.
I'm guessing the amount of salt in seawater must be extremely high by human consumption standards. If a super thirsty person starts drinking seawater, I think he gets into an awful lot of trouble in a hurry. I believe the osmosis starts working backwards, and you start giving up fluids, body fluids, to that seawater, and I think it's quite lethal. I'm guessing a human being can't drink more than a couple of teaspoons full of seawater without getting in trouble. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
You could probably survive a bunch of tablespoons of seawater, but I wouldn't suggest you take it at any significant amount of your fluid intake because, as you pointed out, our kidneys are really not designed that efficiently to concentrate sodium. So what happens is it gets rid of free water along with a lower amount of the sodium, and you end up getting dehydrated and having almost as much sodium concentration percentage-wise as you had before. There's roughly about 35 grams of salt in each liter of seawater, whereas in blood fluids, it's only about 9 grams. So it's about four times as salty seawater is.
Wow. There is a YouTube video where somebody took a great big pot full of seawater and boiled it away to see what was left over. And there's an amazing amount of white, pasty stuff, white, solid stuff left in the bottom of that pot, if you saw that YouTube video. Over to you, Roy.
Well, that's what salt water is. I mean, there's fresh water in rivers and lakes, there's seawater, and there's that intermediate that we charmingly call brackish water.
Comments in one way, what? You have places like Mill Pond here in Port Washington and the Great Salt Pond in Block Island, where they deliberately let the water in for a while, and then they closed the gates and let it evaporate and covered the salt that was done. And that was back in the 16 and 1700s.
There are also people who think that sea salt is healthier than ordinary sodium chloride. Is that true, Roy? Does it have a better flavor? Does it have better other chemistry? Or people deluding themselves? Over to you, Roy.
You know me. I'm a bit of a skeptic. There's no proof whatsoever that there's any benefit. There's this strange concept of natural. I tried to assault it in the past by demonstrating that there's a lot of natural poisons out there that will naturally kill us. So natural isn't necessarily all it's cooked to be. Sodium chloride is sodium chloride. If you want to talk about contaminants, you're not really looking I'm not looking for salt as a way of supplementing minerals or otherwise. That's what food's for. Nowadays, we very commonly iodinize the salt. We put a small amount of iodine because people can't eat fish, I guess. So that's a good source of iodine, but they don't want to, so they put it in the salt. But otherwise, you know, it's just marketing. Marketers love to push natural things, and sea salt, I guess, is natural. I mean, I don't think that the salt manufacturers sit there with cauldrons of sodium and chloride making salt. I might be wrong. There's more than enough salt deposits all over the place because of bits of sea that get dried out and leave that layer of salt. So I'm not exactly sure where all the salt comes from, but natural versus synthetic is just in the mind of the beholder from my perspective.
And a comment again on salt comes from N1YDY.
Yes, Hank.
In the United States, the vast majority of the salt that we consume is mined underneath the Great Lakes. Believe it or not, the Great Lakes are on top of one of the largest salt deposits in the world, and Port Lake Huron being the one that comes to mind. And they actually have large mines that are significantly below the lake bed.
I mean, I could believe that entirely, and I don't really see any inherent reason why that sodium is any less than sea salt sodium. If anything, you probably have to be a little bit more cautious with sea salt. Make sure you don't have contaminants that are flooding our seas these days.
KD2FIU.
And after George, I've got a question to Roy. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, Roy, thank you for picking me up, Dick. George here. And Roy, what I've learned in the last few years, it's not the salt on the table, it's the salt on the label. And that's something I've really paid attention to.
Yeah, I've got myself on a low-sodium diet. My body works a lot better on that. And so, therefore, I'm not getting the iodine that people get through salt. Because I eat such little salt, but I like all kinds of fish. Does that mean I'm probably all right? Over to you, Roy.
Dick, it means you're probably all right, because fish have a significant amount of iodine already in them. And to George, yeah, I agree with you in some aspects. Unfortunately, there are people, in addition to eating salty food that's pre-salted for them, they go wacky with their table salt. And, I mean, my father, may he rest in peace, would never taste anything. He would just slather on the salt.
Do you believe he suffered any disadvantage from excess salt?
He had high blood pressure. Now, I don't know if it's totally was 100% related to his sodium intake. It probably certainly wasn't helped. But there are some people that even if they keep their salt intake low, their particular high blood pressure is less sodium related. So it's impossible to know unless you take the sodium away from someone. And this was back in the 60s and the 70s when most guys wouldn't listen to their doctor about a low sodium diet, no matter what they told them.
Can I say this, please? KD2FIU.
George, sure.
I believe it has to do with your body. It's inherent in your body because more people in the world have conditions because of low sodium than high sodium. There is a certain level where it goes below if you're down to a sodium blood level of 110, 115, 120. You're at a very high risk of a lot of problems in the way your body runs. I think it's the way your body does it, and that may be genetic. I don't advocate for anybody to consume high amounts of sodium or salt, but I have seen people shut down because it has gone too low.
George, the condition you're discussing is generally called hyponatremia. Hypo means low. Natremia means sodium in blood. That's kind of rare. Usually it's secondary to some other situation going on, like some forms of kidney failure that spill excess sodium out in the urine. It's very difficult to kind of induce that in a healthy person. I mean, you know, you can give them an overdose of distilled water, I guess, and produce it when you kind of make the kidneys stop being able to function halfway. So, but usually the average Joe public who has a reasonably well-balanced diet, there's enough sodium in all the foods that we eat, and if you have a good kidney that's able to maintain the sodium and potassium balance, you shouldn't really have hyponatremia. It means there's something else going on.
Thank you for the input, KD2FIU. And, yeah, you're right. Oh, the still water can do it.
KDUPS.
Rich.
We turn it back to you, Rich. KGUPS, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I think there's a late for your problem. Here to repeat KGUPS mobile. I'm in Pennsylvania right now, so you're going to ask. One other thing with soda or salt, if you do prepare with cooking, one thing you have to be aware of is that between the different types and also different brands of salt, you will get different amounts in the same volume. So what I'm talking about, particularly say between Morton and Diamond Crystal, and the kosher salt that they sell, if I believe the Diamond Crystal has a much finer or different crystal that allows it to pack in, and let's say if you measure a teaspoon of the Diamond Crystal salt, and yet you measure a teaspoon of Morton salt, there's a difference in how much there is in it. You think you're getting the same amount. So if you're reading a recipe and it calls for salt and a person used one of them, the brands, and then you switch it because they didn't specify which one, you can have a drastically saltier dish that you planned on. So it's hard, so small amounts, but the volume can be different depending on how they lay.
Rich, yeah. Volume is not an accurate way of judging things. The accurate way is mass or weight of the material, because as you pointed out, there are some things like kosher salt that are much more granular. There's a lot of empty space between each grain, and there are others that are more finely ground up that pack much tighter and are heavier with the same volume. So densities are different depending upon the size of the grains, and that has certainly has an effect on your salt intake. If you're taking twice the mass of salt, that's going to have twice the effect, even if it takes up the same volume in your teaspoon.
That's correct. And it's not as critical. You're cooking, say, making spaghetti sauce, and you're salting it, because then you're going to be tasting it. You should never just arbitrarily season anything without tasting it, but particularly cookies, cakes, breads, and things, the amount of salt, most people don't taste the raw salt. You see, if there's enough salt in there, they go by the recipe, and that's where you can run into trouble. One, it'll make it taste more salty, or if you're making yeasted breads and you put too much salt in it, the salt will inhibit or at least slow down the action of the yeast. So it'll take a lot longer to rise for you to get to where you can make it. So just something to keep in mind.
Thanks, Rich. And also, in addition, you have to understand, again, the human body works in mysterious ways. Our ability to sense the amount of salt on our tongue is dependent upon the amount of salt that we take in, the concentrations. If we take in a lot of salty food, our brain kind of dampens the signal, and we don't quite realize how salty it is. So every so often, someone has experienced the oddity of cutting out salt in their diet for X number of weeks or months, and then eating something that they once loved that had salt in it, and barely being able to swallow it because it was so darn salty to them at that time. So again, it's another example of human physiology and how our nerves are kind of cutting corners on us. We can't detect the salt concentration in our tongue. We just register it as saltier than usual or less saltier than usual. And so that's open to a lot of interpretation.
Yeah, I've run into that, Roy, where my wife and I have been on a somewhat low salt diet for a while. And normal saltiness now touches us as an extreme. We should go over to Paul. We've cut him awful short, Paul. Back to you for any final comments, Roy.
No, I said my piece. I did my two puzzles. I had a bunch of stories, but that can wait until next week, and hopefully I'll figure out a couple of puzzlers for next week as well. So thanks, Dick, and thanks, Paul, for giving me the time to do it. And thanks for everyone who participated. And as always, mailbag@ac2gs.com for any topics or questions or anything. And all, the few things that I talked about, I'll have some links to on roy.ac2gs.com. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. And I'll hand it over to Dick. We'll hand it over to Paul.
Yeah, even on a holiday weekend, you got lots of participation tonight. So sounds good. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW. Here comes the space report.
Very good. Great topics. Very interesting. Especially about the kidneys. Yeah, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And like I was saying before, there aren't as many launches lately. This time of year, they tend to cut back anyway. They know there's storms in the ocean, and you know, this is the hurricane season. And they're right about that one. They have a Category 5 coming very near the Cape, but they didn't have that many flights planned. The next one out of the Cape that would be important would probably be in October, and that would be the Starliner by Boeing, which is going to be a crewed spacecraft without the crew going up to the space station. So I'm looking forward to that. That would be an Atlas V launch from Launch Complex 41. Let me drop it. And then you have a crew going up, but that's going to be from Kazakhstan, in a Russian Soyuz vehicle. You're going to send three more people up to the space station at the end of this month. And then from Japan, you have a cargo vehicle, the HTV number 8. That'll be the 8th one that they've done. They do roughly one a year from Japan. They launch it on a rocket. And their rocket is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they have the H2A and B. The A is used for all their satellites, and B is used for the cargo vehicle, the HTV. Which is right for now, it brings up the most mass to the space station, roughly around 12,000 pounds. That will be the one with a lot more lithium batteries. Each battery, there's hundreds and hundreds of pounds of batteries. Think of like a car battery, but maybe of the equivalent of about 40 of those that will be going up on that rocket. They need to change out another whole group. They'll remove 12 and put in six new lithium batteries in one of the areas on the space station. They've already done two, and this will be a third, and eventually they'll do a fourth section of the space station. But like I said, doesn't look like. I hope they don't wind up with problems down in Florida with the hurricane. But in case they do, they already used the crawler. Remember the old crawler that they used for the shuttle and for the Saturn V rockets. They used the crawler to move the launch complex tower away, you know, away from where it was located out in 39B, back to the vehicle assembly building. They put it inside to protect that tower from blowing over. A lot of that stuff is capable of handling our Category 1, but the vehicle assembly building could handle probably Category 2. The highest winds ever recorded at the Cape were around 115, and if this thing ever came on shore, they're going to have a lot of problems. We hope that don't happen. What I want to talk about is a website that I, or actually a video that I sent to roy.hc2gs.com website, and this has to do with a launch that took place last Tuesday. If you listen to it now on a regular basis, I've been talking about SpaceX, new space vehicle that they're trying to build. It's called the Starship. And that will be eventually built so it can go to the moon and go to Mars. But of course, that's not built yet, but they're making headway. They've made headway with the rocket engines. They're called the Raptor engines. And compared to what they use on the Falcon rockets, the Falcon 9 rockets are called Merlin engines. Merlin engines are around 220,000 pounds of thrust, and this is twice that amount, around 440,000 pounds of thrust. And the difference is eventually when they launch to the moon or to Mars, they plan on putting 39 of these engines on the first booster. And, you know, compare that to the nine engines that are half the power each on the Falcon 9. So we're looking at maybe a 13 million pound thrust vehicle eventually leaving Earth. But for now, they're just developing it. They finally got one Raptor engine operating. And they've tested it and successfully got this gigantic contraption off the ground called the Star Hopper. You know, instead of a grasshopper, it's the Star Hopper. The test vehicle to see if they could throttle this new Raptor engine properly so that it could not only take off, but move over to a landing pad right nearby and see if it can come back down. You know, so with one engine, with this massive vehicle, and the vehicle is massive, it's about 30 feet in diameter and around 65 feet high. You know, it was actually, it looks like a gigantic tank with four legs sticking out of it. And they've tested this over the months. They got it off the ground, you know, a couple of inches, and then about 3 weeks ago, they got it off the ground, and it went around 60 feet in the air, but it was so much smoke, you couldn't see anything. So they wanted to try this last week, 2 weeks ago, to see if they can get this thing off the ground, like 600 feet into the air. And sure enough, they had an abort. They had problems with the connectors that go to the igniters. It's a long, complicated system, but they're not using the same TTEP system that the Falcon 9 uses. You won't see the green flame right before they launch. You know, that's what they use for the igniter. This is an all-liquid methane vehicle and liquid oxygen. And if they got it off the ground, it would be really the first good flight of a liquid methane engine. So sure enough, they tried again last Tuesday, and I got to see this live. And none of the big news agencies were out there, CNN or NBC. Nobody was out there looking at this. So you have some people that are, you know, that do these. They're really rocket enthusiasts. They go out and they take pictures, and sure enough, that's the way I was able to see it. And they waded out to the fields, getting bit up by mosquitoes and everything, until this thing took off. Sure enough, the Star Hopper started up. It's only got the one engine. The thing took off beautifully. Left the pad, no problem. And then sure enough, rose above the clouds of smoke. And
and get higher and higher. It got to around 560 feet into the air, around 50 stories high, and then moved over, translated. It's got some nitrogen jets on top, and then you could see the one Raptor engine on the bottom moving back and forth. It's gimbaled, so you know it's keeping this thing level, and the whole spacecraft moved over and landed into a it's got a big landing pad with an X, X marks the spot, for SpaceX, and it landed dead center. I mean, perfectly. So that's a it's a good step forward for SpaceX. And I really thought it was great, so I sent it over to Roy, and he's got it now on his website. You bring it up, it's by spaceflight.com. They're the ones that put it on. And you just click on that video. It's only 1 minute long, but you're actually watching history. This is the first liquid methane vehicle really to operate. And a lot of the future vehicles are starting to go with liquid methane. They're all going to start, not all, but they're going to start getting away from the RP-1, which is really nothing but liquid kerosene. They're getting away from that, and they're going with liquid methane. And you have the future Starship rocket that we're talking about. That will be methane. Blue Origin is building the New Glenn, and that vehicle is also going to be all methane and liquid methane. That will be another massive rocket, more powerful than the Saturn V rocket when that gets developed probably another 2 years ago on that, I would think, probably 2021. And then the newer rocket that Boeing and Lockheed is developing to take over and replace the Atlas V, which has been very reliable over the years, and it's also going to replace the Delta IV, and they call that the Vulcan rocket, and that will also be liquid methane. So, and there's some other companies around the world that are interested in also doing liquid methane, and but we'll see how it goes. They're building two more rockets. That was the last test flight of this vehicle. SpaceX is building another one, same diameter as this, 30 feet in diameter. And this one's going to look more like a rocket ship. It's going to have a pointy front to it. This one, the one you're looking at, if you look at this website, it looks like a big upside down garbage can with legs on it. And he's building a Starship rocket in Florida, and he's building a Starship rocket also in Boca Chica, Texas. This launch took place in Boca Chica, Texas. He's built a whole launch complex down in Texas. He's thinking about launching future vehicles from that location, to orbit. When I say he, I mean Elon Musk and SpaceX. So I think it's pretty interesting. I was shocked when this thing took off. I couldn't believe it. Well, I've been following the story, and it looked like they were having some trouble for the last couple of months trying to get this thing up in the air. The engines weren't working right. They'd have to, the engine would be sent back to Texas, and they'd work on it, investigate it, improve it, send back another engine. And eventually, I think this was their sixth engine that they were very successful in getting this thing off the ground. This is WS2N. And I love the CWID. Speaking of SpaceX, at the same time, the exact same day that this was going on, they have a Dragon cargo vehicle attached to the International Space Station, and it was their time to have the robotic arm disconnected from the Harmony module on the space station, one of the 15 modules that are attached to the space station, and disconnect it, and eventually let it go, and outside of a few orbits. You orbited over the Pacific and with a parachute and landed into the Pacific Ocean, a couple hundred miles away from California. And, you know, they were very happy this one went up and came down because this is the third trip for Dragon. You know, we always thought of the shuttle as being reusable. You know, another shuttle going up. Well, which one is it? You know, is it Columbia? Is it Endeavor or, you know, or Atlantis or Discovery? You know, it was up one of the four. Well, this, the same thing is going on with SpaceX. He sends these cargo vehicles up and keeps doing it over and over again. This is the third flight of Dragon, this Dragon cargo to the space station. And it brought up all kinds of good stuff. Last time it went up, it took up the ITER, the International Docking Adapter, which they attached to the space station. And more importantly, as far as the scientists are concerned, it brought back thousands of pounds worth of science from the space station, which I'm sure they'll get their hands on very shortly. They put everything into refrigerated or freezers inside the space, inside of Dragon, and keep everything cold. And the second they get it out of the water, immediately when the door opens up, they transfer it to the scientists wherever it might go. And they brought back investigations dealing with Alzheimer's. They're working on that. Let me drop it. They brought back technical stuff for that they're trying to make called Z-Bland. Z-Bland is a material that they manufacture in space, and it creates a fiber optic cable, really, fiber optic fibers, which, you know, you could eventually put into a cable, which is, like, much more efficient. You could get a lot more broadband out of Z-Bland than you can, out of any other fiber. When it's made on Earth, the quality is not that good, but you put this up into space and manufacture it up there, and that's what they're doing. They're testing it, and I could picture someday some company building like a space station just to build Z-Bland optical fibers, for their high bandwidth. You know, you'll be able to use it for the telecommunication industry, for laser surgeries, remote sensing, and that type of stuff. So that was on board the Dragon, as they brought that back as well. They were testing flexible fuel tanks, instead of having a metal tank or a carbon composite tank that they've been using for forever. Solid tanks for all the different fuels and liquid oxygens and everything that they use in space. They're setting up flexible tanks. They want to see how they work, and then, they send up in one size, the next thing they expand it. And they're bringing those back. They tested it with water up in the space station to see how they worked, expanded and contracted. Put them back onto Dragon, sent them back, and they'll investigate them as well. Other investigations, they have different microbes that they're looking at, and they put that into the freezers. They have synchronized position, hold, engage, reorient experimental satellites called spheres. Now, these spheres are like little round robots, about the size of a big basketball. And they've been floating around on the space station for a couple of years now. And the astronauts have worked with them. They've been controlled from the ground. The idea is to assist the astronauts, over time. And this was the first group that they had sent up, these three spheres, that big long acronym. Now it's time to send them back. The companies will get them back and look them over. Probably wind up in a museum somewhere. But they've already been replaced by the astro bees. Astro bees are a little bit bigger. They're cube-shaped. They've already got two on board the space station, and astronauts have already been working with these things and bringing them up online and seeing how they work, and they're going to eventually be able to help astronauts in space. But nevertheless, they brought the spheres back, and the new astro bees are operational. They got all kinds of AI attached to it. They have tablets attached to it where it could float over to an astronaut, and the astronaut could bring something up or whatever it might be. It could look for equipment on board the space station. And eventually it goes back to its own charging location. So that was pretty good. Last week I talked about the Russian robot. His name is Fedor, F-E-D-O-R, or Skybot F-850. It also goes under that name. And that's the one that AC-2GS talked about many, many months ago. And it was on Earth at the time, and I think it could shoot guns, it could turn valves. But now they decided, let's put it onto a Soyuz spacecraft, a crew vehicle without a crew, and send it up to the space station. The reason for it is they wanted to test this new Soyuz vehicle out, and everything went fine until they tried to dock. It turned out there's nothing wrong with the vehicle itself. There was something wrong with one of the sensors at the docking platform where it was going to dock to. What they call the docking port. So, long complicated story short, basically they took a spacecraft out of one port and put it into another to do that. They used the whole crew, three people had to get in there and do that. And then they were able to dock this robot vehicle autonomously by itself. Then it was going to a port with a good sensor on board that was able to communicate with its radar. So that worked out okay. And, one other quick topic, because I got a couple of minutes left, is the X-37B. And if you don't know what that is, it's a spacecraft that is run by the government, not NASA. So this thing has wings on it, looks like a small space shuttle. It has wheels on it. It's gone up a number of times. In fact, it's up there now for the fifth time. And they have two of these, so they take turns. One will go up for a half a year, eventually a year, and then they come back. And they're essentially spy satellites. It'll go up, launch on an Atlas V rocket, go to orbit, low Earth orbit. It's got a cargo bay that opens up, solar panels that come out, and it's got a Hall thruster on there for changing its location in space. Hall thruster is essentially like an ion engine. And then they eventually bring it back. The first few landings took place in California, Edwards Air Force Base, and future landings took place in Florida. Now, these are billion-dollar vehicles and project, but again, not paid for through NASA. When they talk about the NASA budget, this isn't it. This is military or NRO, National Reconnaissance Office type of budget. Comes out of the military end of things. And it turns out that budget is actually about over two times the amount that the NASA budget is. So the military and spy, space world is actually two times. We pay two times the amount of money into that than we do for NASA. Anyway, there's one up there now that was launched a while back, and over 700 days now. So it's broke its record, and eventually they'll bring it back. And these things stay up for, like I said, originally 6 months and then a year. As one comes back, another one gets launched. and it's very versatile, too, as well. Launched on an Atlas V rocket, you know, it's an American rocket that we use all the time. And they also launched on a SpaceX rocket. They put a big fairing around it, and Falcon 9 launched one of these things into space. So, you know, if in case one rocket is down, another one would be capable of doing the same job, getting the spy vehicle into space.
Okay, I'll save the rest
for next week. We could revisit a couple of more topics, and I'll just turn it back to you, Dick, for any comments or questions. K2RIW, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet.
On a quick break, Paul, any new news with James Webb? I think I read an article saying James Webb has been completely put together for the first time. Is that true?
That was the end of my list. Yes, it is. They've got the whole top part and the electronics on the base and attached to the sunshade as well. And they're going to put, make sure everything operates before they put that up into space in, I think, June of 2021 at the time.
So we're still almost 2 years from launch. Oh, well. I'm really looking forward to that one. Good stuff. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Roy. Thank you guys for participating on a weekend when I thought we had nobody signing in. Boy, was I surprised. K2RIW, TechNet Limark, we're clear for now. Enjoy, you guys. See you next week. Oh, Roy, one quick question, Roy. It's not next week, it's the week after next, which I think you will be absent. Is that true, Roy?
The very last Sunday, so it's probably Sundays from now.
Okay. We'll not be looking forward to not seeing you that Sunday. Okay, Roy. Bye-bye. And, K2RIW clear but listening.
And this WS2N, and if everybody takes a minute and goes to Roy's website and looks at this launch, it's something you probably never see before. Probably never see again either. It's really different.
Give us a couple words as to what makes it so different, Paul.
It's only like a 1 minute video, but to watch this thing and understand that it's 30 feet in diameter, 65 feet high, one engine, 440,000 pounds of thrust, which is a tremendous amount of thrust. The thrust that put Alan Shepard into a suborbital flight was 70,000 pounds of thrust. And this thing's 440, and it's only one little engine. And eventually it's going to be 35 of these things. But this is the first one. And you watch this thing with four big legs leave the ground, and with a cloud of dust all over. But it gets above it, and you can see in the background the Texas horizon, and then this thing floats over, and it goes down right on the money onto the landing spot, right next to more or less where it took off. It's just interesting. It's a piece of work, a terrific engineering. Back to you, Dave.
And once again, Roy, how many feet in diameter? I can't believe what I think I heard. Go ahead.
30 feet. 30, and it's only got the one engine on the bottom, and eventually it's going to have 35. So that's one 30 feet in diameter, 65 feet high. It's got a round top, no pointy top. It's really different, but they wanted to test it to see if they could control it, to see if they could move it. Can it go translate to the left? Can it land on the money? And it worked out.
Did that craft have paddles on the top to steer it on the way down, Paul?
Negative. No, it had some nitrogen thrusters. You can see, they call them gas thrusters, but nitrogen.
And you call that one little engine? That sounds like one fantastic design. Thank you.
You got to check it out. And the website I saw it on was really run by a fellow named. Tim Dodd, he's called the Everyday Astronaut. He does a lot of, he's very, very informative. But he goes to these sites and he's noise. Got to see it through that. But this picture that they have, it was taken from the drone, apparently, it's much better angle. It's pretty good.
I might check in and you can cover this one for a while.
Okay, you're about to be cut off in a few seconds. Go ahead, Joe.